answered. But first, I want to be sure that you're not lying. Let's go. Take me to where that worm is hiding. I went to get my rifle, and we left the house. The child told me we would have to go on horseback, because Pedro III was hidden in the Libas's sawmill several miles from Tres Marias. How could I have failed to think of that? It was a perfect hideout. The German sawmill was always shut at that time of year, and it was hard to reach from all the main roads. How did you find out that Pedro III Garcia is hiding there? Everybody knows but you, sir, he replied. We took off at a trot, because in that terrain you couldn't gallop. The sawmill is set into a mountainside where a horse can't go fast. With the effort of the climb, the horse's hooves struck sparks from the stones. I think the noise of their hooves was the only sound for miles around on that sultry, quiet afternoon. When we came into the forest, the landscape changed and it grew cooler. The trees rose up before us in narrow rows that barely let the sun in. The ground was a soft, reddish carpet into which the horse's feet gently sank. We were surrounded by silence. The boy rode ahead of me, bareback on his horse, as close to the animal as if they were a single body, and I was behind, taciturn, brooding over my rage. At moments, sadness swept over me, stronger than the fury I had been hatching all this time, stronger than the hatred I felt for Pedro III Garcia. It must have been 2 hours before we glimpsed the low sheds of the sawmill, arranged in a half-circle in a clearing in the woods. The smell of wood and pine was so intense that for a moment I was distracted from the business at hand. I was overcome by the landscape, the forest, the silence. But that momentary weakness lasted only a second. "Wait here and look after the horses. Don't move." I dismounted. The boy took the reins and I began to walk in a crouch, my rifle in my hands. I didn't feel my 60 years or the pain in my old crushed bones. I was propelled forward by the thought of revenge. A frail column of smoke was rising from the roof of one of the sheds, and I saw a horse tied to the door. I deduced that that was where Pedro III must be hiding, so I headed toward that shed. My teeth were chattering with impatience. I had decided not to kill him with the first shot, because that would be too quick and all my pleasure would be gone in only a minute. I had waited so long for this moment that I wanted to savor it, but I also didn't want to give him a chance to escape. He was much younger than I, and if I didn't take him by surprise, I was done for. My shirt was soaked with sweat and was clinging to my body. A veil had descended over my eyes, but I felt 20 years old and had the strength of a bull. I crept silently into the shed, my heart pounding like a drum. I found myself inside a large warehouse whose floor was covered with sawdust. There were huge stacks of wood, and some machines covered with green canvas to protect them from the dust. I continued inching forward, hiding behind the wood piles, until suddenly I saw him. Pedro III Garcia was stretched out on the floor, his head on a folded blanket. He was sound asleep. Next to him was a small fire and a crock for boiling water. I stopped short, taken aback, and stared at him with all the hatred in the world, trying to fix in my memory forever that dark face with the almost childlike features, on which the beard looked like part of a disguise, and I could not understand what my daughter had seen in that ordinary-looking long hair. He must have been about 25, but asleep he looked like a boy. I had to make an enormous effort to stop the shaking in my hands and teeth. I raised my gun and took a few steps forward. I was so close to him that I could have blown his head off without even aiming, but I decided to wait a few seconds for my pulse to quiet down. That moment was my downfall. I believe the habit of hiding must have sharpened Pedro III Garcia's hearing, and instinct told him that he was in danger. In a split second he must have waked up, but his eyes remained closed. He alerted all his muscles and concentrated all his energy into a single, unbelievable leap that left him standing 3 feet away from where my bullet landed. I had no chance to aim again, for he crouched down, picked up a piece of wood and hurled it at me, striking my gun, which flew out of my hand. I remember feeling a wave of panic at being suddenly unarmed, but then I realized that he was more scared than I was. We looked at each other in silence, panting, each awaiting the next move of the other. Then I saw the axe. It was so close to me that I could reach it by hardly extending my arm, which is what I did without a second thought. I took the axe, and with a wild scream that rose from my guts, I rushed forward, prepared to rip him down the middle with a single stroke. The axe gleamed in the air and fell on Pedro Tercero Garcia. A shower of blood hit me in the face. At the very last second he raised his arms to stop the axe, and the edge of the tool sliced off 3 fingers of his right hand. The force of the blow thrust me forward, and I fell on my knees. He held his hand to his chest and ran out the door, leaping over the wood piles and the logs on the floor. He reached his horse, jumped into the saddle, and disappeared with a terrifying scream into the shadows of the pine trees. He left a trail of blood behind him. I remained on all fours, crouching and gasping for breath. It took me several minutes to calm down and realize that I hadn't killed him. My first reaction was one of relief, because the feel of his warm blood on my face had quickly taken the edge off my hatred, and I had to make a real effort to remember how badly I had wanted to kill him to explain the violence that was suffocating me, making my chest nearly burst, my ears buzz, and my eyes cloud over. I opened my mouth in desperation, trying to get some air into my lungs, and managed to rise to my feet, but I began to shake. I took 2 steps, and then I fell, landing on top of a pile of boards, sick to my stomach and unable to catch my breath. I thought I was going to faint. My heart was leaping in my chest like a machine gone wild. A long time must have passed. I don't know. Finally, I looked up. I rose to my feet again and picked up my gun. The child Esteban Garcia was by my side, staring at me silently. He had picked up the sliced-off fingers and was holding them like a bouquet of bloody asparagus. I couldn't keep from retching then. My mouth filled with saliva and I vomited all over my boots while the boy smiled impassively. "Drop that, you filthy brat," I shouted, striking him in the hand. The fingers fell onto the sawdust, staining it red. I picked up my gun and walked trembling toward the door. The cool evening air and the overwhelming scent of pine hit me in the face, bringing me back to reality. I inhaled eagerly, gulping the air. With great difficulty, I made my way to my horse. My whole body ached and my hands were numb. The boy followed me. We returned to Tres Marias, groping our way in the dark, which fell quickly once the sun had set. The trees made it difficult to advance. The horses tripped on the stones and brush. Branches whipped us in the face. I was in another world, confused and terrified at my own violence, grateful that Pedro Tercero had escaped, because I knew if he had fallen to the floor I would have continued striking with the axe till I killed him, destroyed him, cut him into little pieces with the same determination that had made me want to shoot him between the eyes. I know what people say about me. Among other things, they say that I've killed several men. They've accused me of murdering some peasants. It isn't true. If it were, I wouldn't mind admitting it, because at my age you can say those things with impunity. I don't have long to go before I'll be in the ground. I've never killed anyone, and the closest I came to doing so was the day I picked up an axe and threw myself on Pedro Tercero Garcia. It was night when we got home. I eased down from the horse and walked toward the terrace. I had completely forgotten about the little boy who had accompanied me, because the whole trip back he hadn't said a word, so I was surprised to feel him tugging at my sleeve. "Now can I have the reward, sir?" he asked. I sent him packing with a slap. There's no reward for traitors, I snarled. And furthermore, I forbid you to tell anyone about what happened. You understand? I entered the house and went directly to the liquor cabinet. The brandy burned my throat and restored a bit of warmth to my body. Then I lay down on the sofa, breathing hard. My heart was still throbbing and I felt dizzy. With the back of my hand, I wiped off the tears that were running down my cheeks. Outside, Esteban Garcia stood before the bolted door. Like me, he was weeping with rage.
7. The Brothers. Clara and Blanca arrived in the city looking like disaster victims. Both had swollen faces, eyes red from crying, and rumpled clothes from the long train ride. Blanca, weaker than her mother, although she was taller, younger, and heavier, sighed when she was awake and sobbed while she slept, in an uninterrupted lament that had begun the day of the beating. But Clara had no patience with misfortune, so when they reached the big house on the corner, which was as empty and lugubrious as a mausoleum, she decided that there had been enough weeping and moaning, and that the time had come to bring some joy into their lives. She insisted that her daughter help her in hiring new servants, opening the shutters, removing the sheets that had been draped over the furniture and lampshades, unlocking the padlocks on the doors, shaking off the dust, and letting in light and air. They were in the middle of doing all this when the unmistakable aroma of wild violets invaded the house, alerting them to the arrival of the three Mora sisters, who, whether out of telepathy or sheer affection, had come to visit. Their happy chatter, cold compresses, spiritual counsel, and personal charm restored the bruised bodies and grieving souls of both mother and daughter. "We'll have to buy some new birds," Clara said, looking out the window at the empty cages and at the weed-choked garden where the statues of the Olympian gods stood naked and covered with pigeon droppings.
"I don't understand how you can think about birds when you don't even have your teeth, Mama," said Blanca, who was still not used to her mother's new toothless expression. Clara saw to everything. Within 2 weeks, the cages were filled with new birds, and she had ordered a porcelain bridge that could be attached to her remaining molars. But the thing turned out to be so uncomfortable that she preferred wearing her denture on a ribbon around her neck. She put it in only to eat and, on occasion, for social gatherings. Clara brought life back to the house. She ordered the cook keep a stove always lit and told her she should be prepared to feed a large number of guests at a moment's notice. She knew why she said it. Within a few days, her spiritualist friends, the Rosicrucians, the Theosophists, the acupuncturists, the telepathists, the rainmakers, the peripatetics, the Seventh-day Adventists, and the hungry or otherwise needy artists began to appear, all those who had habitually been part of Clara's court. Clara reigned over them like a small, happy, toothless queen. It was then that she began her first serious attempts to communicate with extraterrestrial beings and that, as she herself noted, she began to have her first doubts regarding the spiritual messages she received from the pendulum and the three-legged table. She often said that perhaps it was not the souls of the dead, wandering in another dimension, but rather beings from other planets who were trying to establish a relationship with Earthlings, but who, when they were made of an intangible matter, could easily be confused with souls. That scientific explanation enchanted Nicolás, but it did not enjoy the same reception with the Mora sisters, who were extremely conservative. Blanca lived wholly apart from all these doubts. To her, beings from other planets belonged in the same category as souls, and therefore she could not fathom her mother's passionate interest in identifying them. She was very busy with the house, because Clara had once more turned her back on all the household chores, claiming that she never had an aptitude for them. Keeping up the big house on the corner required an army of servants, and her mother's entourage forced them to maintain 24-hour shifts in the kitchen. Grains and grasses had to be prepared for some, vegetables and raw fish for others,
fruit and sour milk for the three Mora sisters, and succulent meat dishes, desserts, and other poisons for Jaime and Nicolás, who had insatiable appetites and still had not developed their own favorite dishes. In time, both of them would know hunger. Jaime, out of solidarity with the poor, and Nicolás, to purify his soul. But in those days, they were still two robust youngsters eager to enjoy life's pleasures. Jaime had begun at the university, and Nicolás was wandering about in search of his destiny. They owned a prehistoric car, which they had bought with the proceeds from the silver platters they had stolen from their parents' house. They called it Covadonga, in memory of their Del Valle grandparents. Covadonga had been taken apart and put back together with other pieces so many times that it barely ran. It moved with a deafening roar from its rusty motor, spewing smoke and bolts from its exhaust pipe. The brothers shared it solemnically. On even days, it belonged to Jaime, and on odd, to Nicolás. Clara was very happy to be living with her sons, and was determined to establish a friendly relationship with them. She had had very little contact with them when they were small, and in her haste to see them become men, she had lost the best hours with her sons and been forced to keep all her tender feelings to herself. Now that they had attained adult proportions and were finally grown, she could give herself the pleasure of spoiling them as she should have when they were small. But it was too late, for the twins had been raised without her caresses, and they no longer needed them. Clara realized that her sons did not belong to her. She did not lose her head over this, or her optimistic frame of mind. She accepted the young men as they were, and was prepared to enjoy their company without expecting anything in return. Blanca, however, grumbled because her brothers had transformed the house into a pigsty. In their wake, they left a trail of destruction, damage, and noise. The young woman was gaining weight before everybody's eyes, and daily grew more languid and ill-tempered. Jaime noticed his sister's belly and went to see his mother. "Mama, I think Blanca's pregnant," he said without beating around the bush. "I thought so myself, dear," his mother said, sighing. Blanca did not deny it, and once the news was confirmed, Clara wrote it down in her notebooks that bore witness to life. Nicolás raised his eyes from his study of Chinese horoscopes and suggested that they ought to tell their father, because within a few more weeks it would be impossible to conceal the matter, and everybody would find out. "I'll never tell who the father is," Blanca said with determination. "I'm not talking about the father of the child. I'm talking about our father," said her brother. "Papa has the right to hear it from us before someone else tells him." "Send a telegram to the countryside," Clara suggested sadly. She realized that when Esteban Trueba found out, Blanca's baby would become a tragedy. Nicolás composed the message with the same cryptographic spirit he employed in writing poems to Amanda, so that the local telegraph operator would not understand the message and start spreading gossip. "Blanca expecting. Send instructions. Stop." Esteban Trueba was as mystified as the telegraph operator and was forced to call his family in the city to understand what they had meant. It fell to Jaime to explain the matter, and he added that the pregnancy was so advanced that there was nothing to be done. There was a long, terrible silence at the other end of the phone, and then his father hung up the receiver. In Tres Marias, livid with anger and surprise, Esteban Trueba picked up his cane and destroyed his telephone for the second time. It had never crossed his mind that a daughter of his could commit such a monstrous folly. Knowing who the father was, it took him only a fraction of a second to regret he had not shot him in the head when he had the chance. He knew that the scandal would be the same whether she gave birth to a bastard child or married the son of a peasant. Society would condemn her in either case. Esteban Trueba spent several hours pacing back and forth in his house, smashing his cane against the furniture and the walls, muttering curses between his teeth, and concocting ridiculous plans that ranged from sending Blanca to a convent in Extremadura to beating her to death. Finally, After he calmed down a bit, a miraculous idea occurred to him. He had his horse saddled and galloped off in the direction of the town. He found Jean de Satigny, whom he had not seen since the disastrous night when he had awakened him to tell him about Blanca's amorous adventures, sipping unsweetened melon juice in the only pastry shop in town. He was accompanied by the son of Indalecio Aguirrazabal, a dandified weakling with a high-pitched voice who was reciting the poetry of Rubén Darío. Without a trace of respect, Trueba lifted the French count by the lapels of his impeccable Scottish jacket and carried him straight out of the tea room, practically dangling in mid-air before the astonished stares of the other customers. He set him down in the middle of the sidewalk. "You've given me enough problems, young man," he said. "First the business with your damn chinchillas, and then my daughter. I've had enough. Go get your things, because you're coming with me to the city. You're going to marry Blanca." He did not give him time to recover from the shock. He accompanied him to the local hotel, where he waited with his whip in one hand and his cane in the other, while Jean de Satigny packed his bags. Afterward, he took him directly to the station and unceremoniously loaded him onto the train. During the trip, the Count tried to explain that he had nothing to do with all of this and that he had never so much as touched Blanca Trueba, and that probably the one responsible for what had happened was the bearded priest Blanca met down by the river every night. Esteban Trueba seared him with his fiercest look. "I don't know what you're talking about, son. You must have dreamt that." Trueba proceeded to explain to him the various clauses of the marriage contract, which did a great deal to assuage the Frenchman's fears. Blanca's dowry, her monthly income, and the prospect of inheriting a considerable fortune eventually brought him around. "As you can see, this is a better proposition than the chinchillas," concluded his future father-in-law without noticing the young man's nervous whimpering. So it was that on Saturday, Esteban Trueba arrived at the big house on the corner with a husband for his deflowered daughter and a father for the little bastard. Esteban was shooting sparks of rage. With a sweep of his hand, he knocked over the pot of chrysanthemums in the entryway and slapped Nicolás, who attempted to intercede and explain things, and he announced that he did not want to see Blanca, who was to remain locked up until her wedding day. Clara did not come out to greet him. She stayed in her room and did not open her door even after he broke his silver cane in two trying to break it down. The house entered a whirlwind of activity and quarrels. The atmosphere seemed unbreathable, and even the birds fell silent in their cages. The servants ran about on orders from their brusque, anxious patron, who allowed for no delays in the execution of his wishes. Clara continued with her life, ignoring her husband and refusing to speak to him. The groom, a virtual prisoner of his future father-in-law, was settled into one of the numerous guest rooms, where he spent his time pacing the floor with nothing to do, without seeing Blanca, and not understanding how he had ended up in this melodrama. He did not know whether to feel sorry for himself for having fallen victim to these savage aborigines, or to rejoice at being on the verge of fulfilling his dream of marrying a rich, young, beautiful South American heiress. As he was of an optimistic bent and endowed with the common sense typical of all his countrymen, he opted for the second interpretation, and by the end of the week, he had begun to relax. Esteban Trueba set the date of the wedding for 2 weeks hence. He decided that the best way to avoid a scandal was to go out and meet it by throwing a spectacular affair. He wanted to see his daughter married by the bishop in a white gown with an 18-foot train held aloft by pages and flower girls. He wanted her photograph to appear in the society pages of the local papers, and he wanted there to be a Caligula-esque party with sufficient fanfare and expense that no one would notice the belly of the bride. The only one who agreed with all his plans was Jean de Satigny. The day Esteban Trueba summoned his daughter to take her to the dressmaker and try on her wedding gown was the first time he had seen her since the night of the beating. He was shocked to see how fat she had become, and that her face was covered with blotches.
"I'm not getting married, Papa," she said.
"Be quiet," he roared. "You're getting married. I don't want any bastards in the family, do you hear me?"
"I thought we already had several," Blanca replied.
"Don't talk back to me. I want you to know that Pedro III Garcia is dead. I killed him with my own hands, so you might as well forget about him and try to be a good wife to the man who's going to lead you to the altar."
Blanca began to cry and continued to weep inconsolably in the days to come. The wedding Blanca had not wanted was held in the cathedral with the blessings of the bishop and a train fit for a queen, sewn by the best tailor in the country, who had performed nothing short of a miracle by disguising the prominent stomach of the bride with layers of flowers and Greco-Roman pleats. The wedding culminated in a spectacular party, with 500 guests in evening dress who invaded the house on the corner, enlivened by an orchestra of hired musicians with a scandalous number of whole steers grilled with herbs, fresh seafood, Baltic caviar, Norwegian salmon, birds stuffed with truffles, a torrent of exotic liquors, a flood of champagne, and an extravagance of desserts, ladyfingers, millefiouilles, eclairs, sugar cookies, huge glass goblets of glazed fruits, Argentine strawberries, Brazilian coconuts, Chilean papayas, Cuban pineapples, and other delicacies impossible to remember, all arrayed on a long table that ran the length of the garden, terminating in a colossal three-story wedding cake designed by an Italian artist born in Naples. This man, a friend of Jean de Satigny, had transformed his humble raw materials, flour, eggs, and sugar, into a replica of the Acropolis crowned with a cloud of meringue, on which rested two mythological lovers, Venus and Adonis, fashioned out of almond paste, colored to imitate the rosy tones of their flesh, their blonde hair, and the cobalt blue of their eyes. With them was a pudgy cupid, also edible, which was sliced in half with a silver knife by the proud groom and the dejected bride. Clara, who from the very start had objected to the idea of marrying Blanca off against her will, decided not to attend the party. She stayed in the sewing room, spinning out dire predictions for the newlyweds, every one of which was borne out to the letter, as all concerned were later able to verify. Finally, her husband came to beg her to change her clothes and make an appearance in the garden, even if only for 10 minutes, to quell the rumors of the guests. She did so unwillingly, but out of love for her daughter, she put in her teeth and managed to smile at the assembled guests. Jaime arrived at the end of the party because he had stayed late working in the clinic for the poor, where he was undergoing his first training as a medical student. Nicolas showed up with the lovely Amanda, who had just discovered Sartre and had adopted the dire look of the European existentialists, dressed all in black, pale-faced, her Arab eyes lined with kohl, her dark hair hanging to her waist, and a jangle of bracelets, necklaces, and earrings that caused a stir wherever she went. As for Nicolas, he was dressed in white like a doctor, with amulets around his neck. His father came out to greet him, took him by the arm, and pushed him into a bathroom, where without a word, he proceeded to pull off all his talismans.
"Go to your room and put on a decent tie. Go back to the party and behave like a proper gentleman. Don't let me catch you preaching some heretical religion among the guests. And tell that witch you've brought along to button up her neckline," Esteban shouted at his son.
Nicolás obeyed him in the worst possible mood. On principle, he was a teetotaler, but he was so furious that he had a few drinks, lost his head, and jumped fully dressed into the garden fountain, from which he had to be rescued with his dignity thoroughly soaked. Blanca spent the entire evening sitting in a chair staring at the cake with a dazed expression, tears running down her face. Meanwhile, her new husband fluttered among the diners,
attributing his mother-in-law's absence to a sudden attack of asthma, and his bride's tears to the emotions of the occasion. No one believed him. Jean de Satigny kept kissing Blanca on the neck, clasping her hands in his, and consoling her with sips of wine and bites of lobster, which he placed directly in her mouth. But it was all in vain. She continued to cry. Despite everything, the party was a great success, just as Esteban Trueba had hoped it would be. The guests ate and drank sumptuously and watched the sun rise as they danced to the strains of the orchestra, while downtown, in the center of the city, groups of unemployed workers huddled around tiny bonfires. Gangs of young men in dark shirts marched around raising their arms in stiff salute, imitating the figures they had seen in German movies. And in the headquarters of the various political parties, the final touches were being put on campaign strategies for the upcoming elections. "The socialists are going to win," Jaime had said, after spending so much time living with the proletariat in the hospital where he worked. He had lost his reason.
"No, Jaime. The ones who always win are going to win again," Clara had replied, for she had seen it in the cards and her common sense had confirmed it. After the party, Esteban Trueba took his son-in-law into the library and handed him a check. It was his wedding present. He had made all the arrangements for the couple to go to the north, where Jean de Satigny hoped to settle down to a comfortable life supported by his wife's income, far away from the comments of astute observers who would not be insensible to the size of his wife's belly. He was thinking about starting a little business of Incan pottery and mummies. Before the newlyweds left the party, they went to say goodbye to Blanca's mother. Clara took Blanca aside and spoke to her in private. The girl still had not stopped crying.
"Stop crying, child," she told her. "Too many tears will hurt the baby and only make it unhappy."
Blanca replied with another sob.
"Pedro Tercero Garcia is alive," Clara added.
Blanca swallowed her hiccups and blew her nose.
"How do you know, Mama?"
she asked.
"Because I dreamt it," Clara replied.
That was enough to reassure Blanca completely. She dried her tears, straightened her head, and didn't weep again until the day her mother died, 7 years later, although it was not for lack of suffering, loneliness, and other causes. Separated from her daughter, with whom she had always been very close, Clara entered another of her confused, depressed periods. Her life went on as before. The big house was always open and full of people, but she had lost her ability to laugh easily and was often to be seen staring straight ahead, lost in thought. She attempted to establish a system of communication with Blanca that would allow them to circumvent the terrible delays of the postal system, but telepathy did not always work, and she was never sure how the message would be received. She could tell that her communiques were being distorted by influences beyond her control, and that the message received never resembled the one she had sent. Besides, Blanca was not given to psychic experiments, even though she had always been extremely close to her mother. She had never shown the slightest curiosity for mental phenomena. She was a practical, worldly, diffident woman, and her modern pragmatic character was a serious obstacle to telepathy. Clara had to resign herself to more conventional methods. Mother and daughter wrote each other almost daily, and for several months their abundant correspondence took the place of Clara's notebooks that bore witness to life. Thus, Blanca was kept abreast of everything that happened in the big house on the corner, and could entertain the illusion that she was still with her family, and that her marriage was only a bad dream. That year, the paths of Jaime and Nicolás separated for good, because their differences had become irreconcilable. Nicolás had discovered flamenco dancing, which he said he had learned from the gypsies in the caves of Granada, even though he had never left the country. Such was the strength of his conviction that even his own family began to wonder.
He offered demonstrations on the slightest pretext. He would leap up on the dining room table, the enormous oak table that had served as Rosa's buyer so many years before and that Clara had inherited, and begin to beat his palms like a madman, tap his shoes spastically, and jump and shout so piercingly that he would attract all the inhabitants of the house, as well as several neighbors and, on one occasion, even the police, who arrived with their nightsticks in hand, tracking mud across the carpet with their boots, but who wound up clapping their hands and shouting, "Olé!" like everyone else. The table resisted heroically, although by the end of the week, it looked like a butcher's table that had been used to slaughter calves. Flamenco dancing had no practical application in the closed society prevailing in the capital back then, but Nicolás ran a discreet announcement in the paper, offering his services as a teacher of that fiery art. The next day, he had a female student, and by the end of the week, word of his charms had got out. Young girls flocked to him in droves. At first they were ashamed and timid, but he would begin twirling them around, tapping loudly while his arm encircled their waists and giving them his most seductive smile, and soon they were enthusiastic. His classes were a great success. The dining room table was on the verge of splintering. Clara was complaining of migraines, and Jaime was locked in his room with wax in his ears, trying to concentrate on his studies. When Esteban Trueba found out what was going on in his house during his absence, he was justly and terrifyingly enraged, and forbade his son to use the house as an academy of Spanish dance or any other thing. Nicolás was forced to give up his contortions, but the whole experience made him the most popular young man of the season, the king of all the parties and of all the young girls' hearts. Because while everybody else was busy studying, dressing in gray checked suits and trying to grow a mustache to the rhythm of boleros, he was preaching free love, quoting Freud, drinking Pernod, and dancing flamenco. His social triumph did not, however, diminish his interest in his mother's psychic talents. He tried in vain to imitate her. He studied vehemently, practiced until his health was in jeopardy, and attended the Friday night sessions with the three Mora sisters, despite his father's express orders to the contrary. For Esteban Trueba persisted in believing that these were not suitable matters for men. Clara tried to console him for his failures. "You can't learn these things or inherit them," she would tell him when she saw him going cross-eyed with concentration in his strenuous efforts to move the salt shaker without touching it. The three Mora sisters loved the boy very much. They lent him their secret books and helped him decipher the mysteries of horoscopes and divining cards. They would form a ring around him, holding each other by the hand, trying to suffuse him with their healing fluids. But that too failed to endow Nicolás with mental powers. They encouraged his love for Amanda. At first, the young woman seemed to be fascinated by the three-legged table and the long-haired artists who flocked to Nicolás's house. But she soon tired of summoning spirits and reciting the poet's verses, so she took a job as a newspaper reporter. "That's a crooked profession," Esteban Trueba declared when he found out. Trueba did not care for her. He did not even like to see her in his house. He thought she was a bad influence on his son, and believed that her long hair, heavily made-up eyes, and glass beads were symptom of some hidden vice, and that her tendency to kick her shoes off and sit cross-legged on the floor like an aborigine was mannish behavior. Amanda had a very pessimistic view of the world, and to get through her depressions, she smoked hashish. Nicolás joined her. Clara noticed that her son often had bad moments, but even her prodigious intuition did not allow her to make the connection between the oriental pipes Nicolás smoked, his strange deliriums, his periodic drowsiness, and his attacks of sudden happiness, because she had never heard of that or any other drug. "It must be his age," she would tell herself whenever Nicolás was acting strangely. "He'll get over it. She had forgotten that Jaime had been born on the same day and did not have such fits. Jaime's madness took on a very different form. He had a calling for both sacrifice and austerity. There were only 2 pairs of pants and 3 shirts in his closet. Clara spent the winters rapidly knitting all sorts of woolen clothes to keep him warm, but he wore them only until someone who needed them more than he did crossed his path. All the money his father gave him ended up in the pockets of the impoverished people he cared for in the hospital. Whenever some emaciated dog followed him in the street, he brought it home. And whenever he heard about an abandoned child, unwed mother, or an old woman who needed his help, he brought the poor ones home so his mother could take care of their problems. Clara became an expert in social benefits. She was acquainted with all the services the state and the church provided for taking care of the disadvantaged. When all else failed, she took them into her own house. Her friends grew afraid of her, for every time she showed up on a visit, it was because she needed something. The network of Clara and Jaime's protégés expanded, to the point where they lost count of how many people they were caring for. They were surprised whenever somebody appeared at the door to thank them for a favor they could not recall. Jaime approached the study of medicine as if it were a religious calling. Any diversion that took him away from his books or used up his time was a betrayal of the people he had sworn to serve. "This boy should have become a priest," Clara declared. For Jaime, who would not have been the least disturbed by the priestly vows of humility, poverty, and chastity, religion was the cause of half of the world's misfortunes. So when his mother would make this comment, he would become furious. He felt that Christianity, like almost all forms of superstition, made men weaker and more resigned, and that the point was not to await some reward in the sky, but to fight for one's rights on earth. These were things he discussed in private with his mother. It was impossible to do so with Esteban Trueba, who quickly lost patience and ended up shouting and slamming doors because, as he put it, he was up to here with living among a bunch of lunatics, and all he wanted was a little normality. But he had had the misfortune of marrying an eccentric and siring 3 good-for-nothing crazies who were ruining his life. Jaime didn't argue with his father. He was like a shadow in the house, giving his mother a distracted kiss whenever he saw her on his way to the kitchen, where, standing up, he would eat everyone else's leftovers before returning to his room and locking himself up to read or study. His bedroom was a tunnel of books, the walls covered from floor to ceiling, with shelves full of volumes no one ever dusted because he always locked his door. They made a perfect nest for spiders and mice. In the center of the room was his bed, actually an army cot, which was lit by a naked light bulb hanging from the ceiling directly above his pillow. During an earthquake that Clara neglected to predict, they heard a roar like that of a derailed train, and when they were able to open the door, they saw that the bed had been buried beneath an avalanche of books. The bookshelves had come loose from the walls, and Jaime had been squashed beneath them. They pulled him out without a scratch. While Clara was removing the books, she remembered the great earthquake, and it seemed to her that she had already lived this moment. The event was an opportunity to sweep the dust from Jaime's lair and chase away the insects and cobwebs with a broom. The only time Jaime ever bothered to focus on the reality of his house was when he saw Amanda walking hand in hand with Nicolás. He rarely spoke to her and blushed violently whenever she spoke to him. He distrusted her exotic appearance and was convinced that if she wore her hair like other women and wiped the makeup off her eyes, she would look like a very thin, greenish rat. Still, he could not keep his eyes off her. The rattle of bracelets that always accompanied her distracted him from his studies, and he had to make an enormous effort not to follow her around the house like a hypnotized chicken. Alone on his bed, unable to concentrate on what he was reading, he would imagine how Amanda looked naked, wrapped in her long black hair with all her noisy adornments, like an idol. Jaime was a recluse. He had been a reticent child and later became a timid man. He did not love himself and perhaps for that reason felt that he did not deserve the love of others. The least manifestation of affection or gratitude toward him made him terribly embarrassed. Amanda represented the essence of everything feminine and, since she was Nicolás's girlfriend, of everything forbidden. The young woman's free, affectionate, adventurous personality fascinated him, and her appearance of a disguised rat aroused him in a tortured eagerness to protect her. He desired her with all his heart, but he would not go so far as to admit it, not even in his most hidden thoughts. In that period, Amanda was often at the Truebas'. She had a flexible schedule at the newspaper, and whenever she could, she arrived at the big house on the corner with her brother Miguel. Their presence went practically unnoticed in that immense mansion, always filled with people and activity. Miguel must have been 5 years old then. He was quiet and clean, caused no special stir, and was able to blend in with the design of the wallpaper and the furniture. He played alone in the garden and followed Clara from one end of the house to the other, always calling her Mama. For this reason, and also because he called Jaime Papa, everyone assumed that Amanda and Miguel were orphans. Amanda took her brother everywhere, even to work. He learned to eat anything, at any time of day, and to sleep in the most uncomfortable places. She swathed him in her passionate and violent love, scratched him like a puppy, shouted at him when she got angry, and ran to hug him when she regretted it. She would not let anyone reprimand him or tell him what to do, refused to listen when people commented on the strange life to which she was subjecting him, and defended him like a lioness, even though no one was planning to attack him. The only one allowed to give an opinion on Miguel's education was Clara, who managed to convince her that he should be sent to school, unless she wanted him to grow up to be an illiterate hermit. Clara was not especially keen on regular education, but she thought that in Miguel's case, it was imperative that he be given a few hours of discipline every day and the opportunity to be with children his own age. She offered to enroll him herself and buy his school supplies and a uniform, and she went along with Amanda on the first day of class. Amanda and Miguel embraced tearfully in the doorway of the school, and the teacher was unable to loosen the little boy from his sister's skirt, to which he clung tooth and nail, shrieking and kicking anyone who came near him. Finally, with Clara's help, the teacher managed to drag the child into the building and close the door of the school behind her. Amanda spent the entire morning sitting outside on the sidewalk. Clara stayed with her, because she felt guilty for having caused so much grief and had begun to doubt the wisdom of her enterprise. At noon, the bell rang and the gate swung open. They saw a herd of pupils, and in their midst, silent and tearless in his proper place with a pencil smear on his nose and his socks deep in his shoes, was little Miguel, who in these few short hours had learned to fend for himself without always holding on to his sister's hand. Amanda clasped him to her breast frenetically. She said in a moment of inspiration, "I'd give my life for you, Miguel." She did not know then that one day she would have to. Meanwhile, Esteban Trueba daily felt more lonely and furious. He had resigned himself to the idea that his wife would never speak to him again. Tired of pursuing her up and down the house, begging her with his eyes and drilling holes in the bathroom wall, he decided to devote himself to politics. Just as Clara had predicted, those who always win won the elections, but by a small margin that the entire country was put on notice. In Trueba's opinion, the time had arrived for him to come out in defense of the national interest and of the Conservative Party, since no one better personified the honest, uncontaminated politician, as he himself declared,
adding that he had pulled himself up by his own bootstraps, and not only that, had created jobs and a decent life for all his workers and owned the only hacienda with little brick houses. He respected the law, the nation, and tradition, and no one could accuse him of any greater offense than tax evasion. He hired a foreman to replace Pedro Segundo Garcia and put him in charge of the broad hens and imported cattle at Tres Marias and settled in the capital for good. He spent several months devoting himself to his campaign, drawing on the support of the Conservative Party, as well as his own fortune, which he placed at the disposal of the cause. The house filled with political propaganda and with the members of his party, who practically took it by storm, blending in with the hallway ghosts, the Rosicrucians, and the three Mora sisters. Clara's retinue was gradually pushed into the back rooms of the house, and an invisible border arose between the parts of the house occupied by Esteban Trueba and those occupied by his wife. In response to Clara's imagination and the requirements of the moment, the noble, seigneurial architecture began sprouting all sorts of extra little rooms, staircases, turrets, and terraces. Each time a new guest arrived, the bricklayers would arrive and build another addition to the house. The big house on the corner soon came to resemble a labyrinth. "Someday this house will make a good hotel," Nicolás declared. "Or a little hospital," added Jaime, who was beginning to cherish the idea of bringing his poor patients to the high district. The facade of the house underwent no alterations. In front, there were still the same heroic columns and the Versaillesque garden, but in the back, the style gradually disappeared. The rear garden was a tangled jungle in which every type of plant and flower had proliferated and where Clara's birds kept up a steady din, along with many generations of cats and dogs. Among that entire domestic fauna, the only one to have any importance in the collective memory of the family was a rabbit Miguel had once brought home, a poor, ordinary rabbit that the dogs had constantly licked until all its hair fell out and it became the only bald member of its species, boasting an iridescent coat that gave it the appearance of a large-eared reptile. As the day of the elections drew near, Esteban Trueba grew increasingly nervous. He had risked everything on this political adventure. One night, he could not bear it anymore and went to knock on Clara's bedroom door. She opened it. She was in her nightgown and had put her teeth in because she liked to nibble crackers while she wrote in her diary. To Esteban, she looked as young and beautiful as the day he had first brought her to this blue-silked, papered bedroom and stood her on Barrabás's pelt. He smiled at the memory. "Forgive me, Clara," he said, blushing like a schoolboy. "I feel lonely and worried. I'd like to stay here for a while if you don't mind." Clara also smiled, but she did not speak. She pointed to the armchair, and Esteban sat down. They remained silent for a while, sharing the plate of crackers and looking at each other in surprise, for they had been living under the same roof a long time without seeing each other. "I suppose you know what's tormenting me," Esteban Trueba said finally. Clara nodded. "Do you think I'm going to win?" Clara nodded again, and Trueba felt completely relieved, exactly as if she had given him a written guarantee. He gave a loud, joyous guffaw. Then he stood up, put his hands on her shoulders, and kissed her on the forehead. "You're fantastic, Clara," he exclaimed. "If you say so, I'll be senator." After that evening, the hostility between them seemed to ebb. Clara still said nothing, but he ignored her silence and spoke normally to her, interpreting her slightest gestures as replies. When it was necessary, Clara used the servants or her children to send him messages. She worried about her husband's well-being, helped him with his work, and accompanied him when he asked her to. Sometimes she smiled at him. 10 days later, Esteban Trueba was elected Senator of the Republic, just as Clara had predicted. He celebrated the event by throwing a party for all his friends and co-religionists, giving a cash bonus to his employees and to the tenants at Tres Marias, and leaving an emerald necklace on Clara's bed beside a bunch of violets. Clara began to attend social receptions and political events, where her presence was required so her husband could project the image of the simple family man that both the public and the Conservative Party found so appealing. On such occasions, Clara put in her teeth and wore some of the jewelry Esteban had given her. She was considered the most elegant, discreet, and charming lady of their social circle, and no one would have dreamt that the distinguished couple never spoke. With Esteban Trueba's new position, there were even more people to attend to in the big house on the corner. Clara had lost count of the number of mouths she fed and the expenses of the house. The bills were sent directly to Senator Trueba's office in Congress, where they were paid with no questions asked. For Esteban had discovered that the more he spent, the more his fortune seemed to grow. He had concluded that Clara, with her indiscriminate hospitality and charity works, was not about to ruin him. At first, political power was like a new toy to him. In middle age, he was the wealthy, respected man he had wanted to be when he was a struggling adolescent without godfathers and with no greater capital than his pride and ambition. But he soon realized that he was as alone as ever. His two sons eluded him, and he had had no further contact with his daughter Blanca. All he knew about her was what her brothers told him, and he simply mailed her a check once a month, faithful to the promise he had made to Jean de Satigny. He was so out of touch with his sons that every conversation he had with them ended in a shouting match. Trueba learned of Nicolás's follies much too late, which is to say, after everyone else was already talking about them. Nor did he know anything of Jaime's life, if it had ever occurred to him that Jaime met frequently with Pedro III García, for whom he had developed a brotherly affection. Trueba would certainly have had a stroke. But Jaime was very careful not to discuss such matters with his father. Pedro III García had left the countryside. After his terrible encounter with his patron, he was taken in by Father José Dulce María in the parish house. The priest treated his hand, but the boy was deeply depressed and spoke constantly of the meaninglessness of life now that he had lost Blanca and could no longer play the guitar, which had been his one consolation. Father José Dulce María waited for the boy's strong constitution to heal his severed fingers. Then he put him on a cart and took him to the Indian reservation, where he introduced him to a century-old blind woman whose hands were clawed from rheumatism, but who was still strong-willed enough to make baskets with her feet. "If she can make baskets with her toes, you can play the guitar without your fingers," she told him. And then the Jesuit told the boy his own story. "I was also in love when I was your age," he said. "My girlfriend was the most beautiful girl in our village. We were going to get married, and she had begun to embroider her trousseau, and I had started saving money to build us a little house when I was called up for military service. When I returned, she had married the butcher and become a fat matronly woman. I was about to throw myself into the river with a heavy stone tied to my feet. But then I decided to become a priest. A year after I took my vows, she became a widow and began to come to church and stare at me with languid eyes." The frank laughter of the gigantic Jesuit lifted Pedro III's spirits and brought a smile to his lips for the first time in 3 weeks. "So you see, my child," the priest concluded, "there's no reason to lose hope. You'll see Blanca again, the day you least expect to." Healed in both body and soul, Pedro III García made his way to the capital with a bundle of clothes and a few coins the priest had taken from the poor box. He had also given him the address of a socialist leader, who took him in and gave him a place to sleep his first few nights in the city, and then found him a job singing folk songs in a bohemian cafe. The young man settled in a working-class neighborhood, in a wooden shack that seemed like a palace to him. His only furniture was a box spring, a mattress, a chair, and two crates for a table. From there he preached socialism and mulled over his disgust at Blanca's having married someone else, refusing to